8% of LAC workers report that their tips have decreased due to enforcing COVID-19 safety measures, whereas 62% of workers report this on average. To help combat this treatment, Blacks need Congress to not only revisit and finally pass legislation for a $15 per hour minimum wage, but to adequately fund the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, EEOC, to investigate instances of harassment and empower businesses to protect their workers. These policies are just the beginning. To meet this moment of urgency, they need policymakers at every level of government to act, but especially federal government to bring their resources to bear on fighting another lost decade for Black workers. Doc Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're discussing those who feel the fire burning. And joining me in the studio, we have Lee Singer, who is a film journalist and video essayist, whose work has appeared in various major newspapers, magazines, and online outlets. He is also a program advisor for the BFI London Film Festival. And Nassim Ahmed, who is a political analyst and writer for Middle East Monitor. Now, Those Who Feel the Fire Burning, directed and written by Morgan Kinibe, is an unconventional, artistic, and powerful documentary about the refugee crisis. The film shows the level of poverty, humiliation, and other afflictions the refugees have to endure as they are stuck in a hopeless situation on the borders of Europe. Welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, that was a very emotional documentary. Lee, if I can start with you first. Now, there's been a wave of documentaries about the refugee crisis. What makes this documentary so unique and different?
Well, I think the first question is it even a straight documentary? I mean, definitions are very fluid, but I would term it an essay film, which is a film that kind of blurs the lines between fiction and documentary and is often operating in a kind of very sort of meditative or contemplative tone with a sort of very, you know, focused first-person thing. And what they do in this film with this kind of free-floating, you know, disembodied point of view is
you're sort of a wandering ghost, aren't you?
You're a ghost, yeah.
In and out of the,
you know,
story.
At the beginning, there's a very harrowing shipwreck, and it's as if one of the people who didn't make it from that crossing is now sort of wandering as a sort of spirit around Europe and sort of encountering various, you know, refugees and sort of experiencing a little bit of each of their stories. So in that sense, it's very unconventional, but very striking as a result.
Mm-hmm. And Nassim, if I could go to you next. What was your take on Those Who Feel the Fire Burning?
Well, when I first watched it, and I agree with Lee, I mean, it's very immersive. It really takes you into the life of a refugee and their experiences. But there isn't a grand narrative. Most documentaries, as we know, they have a clear idea as to where they're going, and you get a sense of what the problem is, what the issues are, and even maybe, you know, recommend some solutions to those problems. That's usually the format of a documentary. But here, you're left with lots of questions, background questions as to where they're from, you know, who are these people? I mean, we know they're refugees, but where are they from? What's their story? Why is this person taking drugs? So it immerses you into their experiences, but leaves me lots and lots of questions about their background and stuff like that.
And that's exactly what I would like to actually ask you about while you're here, to give some context to this situation. Now, this documentary was made a few years ago, but the refugee crisis is still ongoing. So would you say that this documentary will stay relevant for years to come?
I think the experiences of these refugees will be relevant for a long, long time, because these are shared experiences. These are people who have left their homes, and this is a shared experience throughout. Anyone who leaves their homes to a different land, they will face this kind of subjugations, and they will be living on the margins of society. That's how most refugees live. So from an emotional perspective, from this visceral connection which you have with refugees, I think that would be, that would stay with you from a, as a form of art for many, many years to come. But in terms of providing context and information about the real issues about facing refugees in Europe, I don't think it really touches on those, you know, issues much. Like, for example, 5 million refugees coming from Syria, and how that's affecting the socio-political climate within Europe, how that's changing the demography within Europe, and the insecurities it's creating, the political turmoil it's led to. So those kind of questions is not even addressed by the documentary. But in terms of, as I said, as a program which touches on the feelings and the emotions of refugees, I think it will stay with us for a long, long time.
Lee, would you have liked to have seen that, some more political context, some sort of the questions raised while watching this documentary?
It's a tricky one, because on one hand, I really admire the sort of artistry and you know, trying to frame a film about this subject in an entirely different way. It's much more like a sort of Terrence Malick film, you know, with the sort of free-flowing narration. You don't even know who's talking sometimes, or it's not necessarily connected to most traditional feature or documentary films about refugees. You follow a small number of protagonists, and like you say, there's a clear, we're here, we need to get to here, and this is the goal. And so they follow a very sort of traditional narrative thing. Michael Winterbottom's In This World, or Diego Quiroga Diaz's The Golden Dream. You know who these people are, and so it's the film's counting on you to empathise with and then put yourself in the place of those characters. Because this film is doing this much more sort of free-floating, sort of collage-type thing, it maybe loses that direct connection. It's trying to put you in the point of view of someone you don't ever see.
Yeah.
And so therefore, that sort of, you know, empathy that we traditionally get in films, of that's our character, how would I react in that situation? It's not trying to do that. So it loses the sort of specifics that Nazima, and you know, where are we? How long have they been there? All of these facts and sort of details are, you know, deliberately omitted, but it's much more after a sort of experiential type thing. And, you know, there are pros and cons to that approach. I find it very interesting as a film, but if I was studying, you know, if I was trying to understand the refugee crisis in Europe from this film, I'd be left, as Nazim said, with a lot more questions than I had at the beginning.
Well, some really great, interesting points that you made. But I have to say, I really love the transitions between places you see. I think it's quite beautiful. And Lee, we see a refugee child there. What kind of conditions do we see them exposed to in this documentary?
Oh, I mean, it's horrific. I mean, it's, you know, and, you know, what it's showing there is what we've seen so many times also in the news, you know, horrendous scenes of children. Because those are, you know, as much as your heart goes out to anybody in those situations, when it's children who obviously have no concept of the wider, you know, implications and ramifications of what's going on, it's horrific. I mean, from what I've read, the UNHCR website talks about over 65 million displaced people, over 22 million refugees like that right now, and over 50% of those are under 18. So you see the sort of the scale of the tragedy that's affecting everybody, but a very big preponderance of young people, including kids. And it's horrible. I mean, I have a daughter myself. The idea that your young family could be in anything like the situation that we see some of these individuals in is just, it's almost unimaginable. But yet, it's happening right now, you know, countries not very far away from us.
And I think you're right in saying that, and children are bearing the brunt of this crisis. And Nazim, can you shed more light on this? I mean, what other conditions are they exposed to, and what other hardships do they have to endure?
Well, we get a perspective from a doctor I met who was actually going in and out of the refugee camps in Greece. And he was saying, I mean, some basic things like dental health, for example, it's leading to a situation where you have young children who have no access to dental health. So he goes and provides, an NGO which he belongs to goes and provides provisions for dental health, and saying 65% of those, we think it's a minor issue, you know, but all of us know what it feels like when your teeth is aching and it's one of the worst pains you can imagine. Mm. And he's saying young children, you know, facing massive dental problems within these refugee camps. But that's just one example of many of the basic health issues which are lacking in those refugee
camps. There's also the issue of child exploitation, sex trafficking.
That goes without saying. You know, we've had reports after reports which the UN publishes and also EU publishes of child exploitation. And the other day we had a report which showed that refugees on the boats, they were actually forced to jump off, and 50 led to 50 actually dying. So the smugglers, as they were being caught, you know, they forced the refugees to come off the boats. So you hear horrific stories like that, and we see that every single day. But in terms of the real situation on the ground, I think many of them have said that they would rather have not made the trip to Europe and have seen that they're actually stuck in refugee camps with no chance of having any kind of asylum or entry into the country. So
it's interesting that you say that. And Asim, I want to pick up on a point you made just before we went to the clip about how the refugees thought that going to Europe would be the hardest part, but in fact it's the easiest part. Do you think people would be surprised to know this?
I think even our personal experiences, people I've met as well, they say that once they're here, they expect certain level of, you know, certain conditions, certain living standards, and those expectations are not met. And many of them have been stranded, as I said, in camps, some living on streets, hoping that their, you know, lives will improve. But that's the dreams have not really materialized. It's not really dreams; it's basic expectations which they came to Europe for. So we see that, you know, on the streets as well, refugees trying to make a living cleaning windows. You know, these are people who are struggling. You know, they're not being processed properly by the system. Mm-hmm. So we don't know how many of them will actually get any kind of asylum here in the UK. Many in the Scandinavian countries, as Czech Republic, for example, they're actually paying some of the refugees because of their own personal political situations. The far right, you know, getting more and more support. They are actually paying refugees to leave their countries because of their own political situation. As I said, the far right moving, thriving in support. So refugees themselves, they said, you know, it's much, much harder now, and they would prefer to have actually not made the journey. We hear that from refugees in Syria. Not to mean that they're all facing this kind of situation. Most refugees would still prefer to live here in Europe, trying for asylum, because situations in Syria, in Afghanistan, those war-torn countries which have been bombarded for the last decade or so, they'd rather be in this situation where they at least have an opportunity to find some kind of a better living condition than face the bombs and the barrel bombs in Syria or in Afghanistan or other parts of the world as well.
And Lee, I want to bring you in on here. So we see after that perilous journey a refugee makes, do you think there'll be some relief at the end? What was your reaction to this scene?
I mean, I think the entire sort of thesis, if you like, of the film is that these people are in purgatory. So you get this disembodied ghost. And I mean, the
That's
trailer that you showed at the beginning is like, you know, is this heaven? Is this paradise? And it's like, well, if it's not hell, which it could well be, and you see some of the horrendous situations they're living in, it's certainly this limbo. So they are stuck. They're not, you know, they're not citizens now of any country. They're not being looked after where they are. They can't go back to where they came from. And for me, one of the most nerve-wracking scenes I've seen in any film recently was just after the clip that we showed there, where there's the men trying to climb up the huge chains that are moored into the ship to try and get up. And you see this guy going up, and because it's not, you know, Tom Cruise outside an airplane, you know he's safe. But I had no idea if this man was going to make it. And he's very high up. He's really struggling to reach the ship. And it's absolutely nerve-wracking to watch. And you just realise the desperation that you must be, A, to have left your country in the first place, and then still to be trying these very, very sort of risky ways to still, you know, get further away from where you see the danger. So it's really that what it brought it home to me is the desperation and also just the limbo that these people find themselves in. It's heartbreaking.
I think that's a really perfect analogy to describe it as a sense of purgatory, and that the struggle's not over. They're neither here nor there. Lee, you were just talking about purgatory, but death is a very harsh reality that the refugees face almost on a constant basis. What did you feel watching this scene?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because my understanding is that entire sequence is from a short film that Morgan Knibbe made before Those Who Feel the Fire Burning called Shipwreck, and he's literally just put the whole thing in there. And I think there's even clips from a student film he made in Greece. So he's obviously dedicated a huge amount of his time and energy to putting to this issue. And so to put it all together like this, you know, I don't find the film exploitative, but there's one shot, we didn't show it in that clip, but it's from that same sequence where you just see all these Western journalists and people holding up their cameras and looking into it. And I really got a sense of, like, that's kind of us in a way, because, you know, the average citizen of a European country, we see these images, it's so easy to get inured to them and sort of almost numb to what the reality of, you know, the individual stories. And yet we're constantly fed them.
But
and
we're desensitized.
Yeah, it's this weird sort of, not parasitic per se, but it's this weird relationship where we're constantly, you know, people are desperate to get that next shot. You know, some of the horrendous images we've seen of the young boy who drowned at sea, or the young boy sitting in the back of the ambulance covered in sort of soot. I mean, they stay with us, but at the same time it's like, well, is it actually doing anything to make us change our attitude, or, you know, more importantly, the governments of these countries to change their attitude? And that's a really debatable question. I mean, I think the very fact that, you know, a young Dutch filmmaker has spent that amount of time trying to address this issue in a different way is a positive thing. But at the end of the day, you know, the change is going to come from, you know, legislation and governments, you know, changing their ideas. And that's, as always, is the big sticking point.
And Nassim, I want to throw that question at you, actually. Does that resonate with you? I mean, what responsibility do journalists, people in the media have when it comes to covering the refugee crisis?
I mean, that very same, the first question that came to my mind was, it seems there's a sense of voyeuristic, you know, the cameras, the lenses are pointing at the woman crying. Her suffering, for me, in a sense, if you sit within the broader European context, it just seemed there was a disconnect there, because Europe here, the cameraman and the journalist are using this to actually feed a wider anti-refugee, anti-Islamophobic rhetoric that's taking place in Europe at the moment. So for me, they were not using the word exploitation, but I think it was in a sense being exploitative, not the director per se, but the other journalists, because they were using this to show that we are somehow being taken over by these immigrants, these refugees, and we know refugee has shifted politics, not just here in the UK with the Brexit and also in Europe as well, the rise of the far right, and this is all on the back of the refugee crisis. So those shots, those clips, which we really empathise with, those clips which really give us a sense of what it really feels like to be a refugee and the hardships they face, but they are being exploited to actually show a different narrative to the average person here on the streets in Europe, so that, you know, we are being overrun by refugees, our country's been changed, our culture has been taken over.
Is Europe dealing with the crisis very well?
From a narrative point of view, I don't think it is, because it's showing that somehow, you know, the non-Europeans, Muslims in particular, they're taking over the country, which is statistically, it's just completely wrong. It makes no sense whatsoever. 5% of Europeans are Muslims, which is, if you live for another century, the demography will not change much. But I think the rise of the far right is something that's very real, and it's taking place here, not just in Europe, in America, but it's around the world. You know, you see the rise of the far right, and they're exploiting the refugees as the main, you know, main bandwagon. It's something which they're using to actually push this narrative that we are taken over by Muslims, and which really isn't true. And this kind of movie, hopefully, maybe it might stem the tide of people's emotions and senses as to where, you know, what the real problem is. The problem isn't Muslims coming over. The problem is there's wars in Europe which Europeans have actually helped in supporting. Like the Britain is still paying money to the Saudis, and also
it's really interesting that provoked that kind of reaction watching this documentary for you, but I suppose the documentary doesn't address that point so much. But final 20 seconds to you, Lee, what message does this documentary leave you feeling?
Well, I mean, ultimately, even though it's doing it in an unconventional way, it is still very much trying to connect you, the viewer, and probably a Western viewer, to the plight of people from other places who are going through incredible suffering. The fact he's doing it in a more overtly artistic and sort of aestheticized way, then it's debatable whether we get to grips with the facts, but as a sort of a piece of filmmaking, you know, I think it's very valid to try that different approach, but it comes with its pros and its cons.
Well, I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, gentlemen. Thank you very much for joining the Doc Review sofa. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambayati.
follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime basically did not expect to be targeted by the Palestinian side forcefully and immediately after attacking them in the Gaza Strip. In fact, in the past 2 years, the regime failed to realize the gradual readiness of the Palestinians to attack it. We have prepared for you an article written by Saadullah Zarei, a professor of political science at Allama Tabatabai University in Tehran and an expert on international issues. The piece is titled, How Did Israel Lose the War in Gaza? Please stay with us to hear more about the issue. The Palestinians' victory in the recent war was predictable because the Zionist regime had not won any wars in the last 16 years, neither in Lebanon nor in the Gaza Strip. On the other hand, the regime's hands were totally revealed to the Palestinian resistance. Israel could only invade Gaza City and inflict casualties at a level that was itself a point of weakness, as it deprived those supporting the attacks of defending the regime's criminal acts. 5 points should be mentioned about this war. Point number one, the Zionist regime basically did not expect to be targeted by the Palestinian side forcefully and immediately after attacking them in the Gaza Strip. In fact, in the past 2 years, the regime failed to realize the gradual readiness of the Palestinians to attack it. As a result, Zionist circles and even those within the army began to hit out at the Israeli military intelligence service immediately after the war began, on Monday, 10th of May, with the firing of missiles from Gaza towards mercenary settlements. Actually, this unpredictability is Israel's first defeat in this war. Point number two. The absolute passivity of the Zionist regime in this war should be noted. When rockets were fired from Gaza at Jewish settlements in Al-Quds, the regime immediately resolved the three causes of the outbreak of the war to satisfy the resistance movement. Namely, it suspended the Supreme Court ruling against the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, withdrew troops from the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, and vowed to prevent Jewish settlers from harming the Muslim residents of Al-Quds. The regime hoped that with this hasty measure, the situation in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank would calm down and the crisis would subside. But it did not happen, and the residents of Al-Quds and the West Bank clashed with the regime's military forces in various parts, all a testament to the outbreak of a widespread intifada. After a 6-hour delay, the Israeli regime launched strikes on the Gaza Strip, but at the same time tried in the early hours to supposedly act in a way as to not cause civilian casualties, because by experience it had realized that the less the number of martyrs, especially among women and children, the easier it would be for it to manage the war. But the war had begun, and the statements by the commander-in-chief of the army signaled the regime had decided to achieve a quick victory. The Israeli army commander even talked about the need for a ground attack on the Gaza Strip. This is whilst the Israeli regime had in fact reached a consensus on neither expanding the scope of the war nor initiating a ground invasion. Meanwhile, the commander of the Israeli army announced that hitting 250 positions in the Gaza Strip was on the agenda. He thought that in the course of a few hours, the attacks could both remove the resistance brigades from the scene and end the war. However, it was clear that such a position and military action were not based on accurate information and decision-making, because when the resistance brigades naturally entered the operation, they had already thought about moving their equipment and forces. Here, the Israeli regime found itself caught in the same situation it faced during the 33-day war with Hezbollah in Lebanon. There too, Hezbollah had relocated its equipment and forces before the start of the war, so the bombings could not damage its ability. 2 hours after the start of the war, Israel hit 250 positions, but the intensity of the Palestinian missile strikes targeting various areas was not reduced. Thus, from the very first day of the war, the Israeli regime contacted the Egyptian and Qatari authorities for a ceasefire arrangement. Here too, the army entered into negotiations with the Egyptians based on the past miscalculations, but the Palestinian side had raised the ceiling of its demands and was trying to get concessions from the Israeli regime. The Israelis entered Cairo with a request for a ceasefire and left the city empty-handed in the face of new demands by the Palestinian side. Point number 3. The war took place at the right time, and this shows the smartness of the Palestinian side and came as a surprise for the Israeli side. The Zionist regime faced the war at a time when differences amongst its parties and agencies had escalated due to its failure to form a new cabinet despite holding the fourth parliamentary elections in 2 years. The war could not unite them around a single position because it was a time to elect a cabinet. The Israeli attacks and criticisms were directed at Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the Israeli army, rather than the Palestinian resistance movement. Another point is that this war started when the Arab sides supporting the Zionist regime were in a weak position, and the normalization process had reached a deadlock. War this time outshined the option of the failed normalization process. Hence, the choice of the proper time in the war deepened the crisis within the occupied territories and prevented the Arab normalization parties from playing a role in the Palestinian issue. Point number 4. The war for the Palestinian side was an occasion for a show of force. The submission of the Israeli regime to the conditions of the Palestinian resistance was due to the effectiveness of the Palestinian side's show of force strategy. Until now, any war was the show of force by the Zionist regime, and hence the maximum demand of the Palestinian side was to establish a ceasefire. But here, the balance was reversed. The Palestinian side responded to the Israeli crimes and attacks using a variety of weapons with different ranges and various warheads. It attacked the entire geography of the region for 12 consecutive days, sending about 5 million Jews to shelters with a capacity of only 2 million people. The Palestinian resistance was able to redraw the balance of the fire. This is while the attacks of the Israeli army targeted only Gaza City, not the entire Gaza Strip. The Palestinian side acted cohesively in this war, both in terms of the unity of the resistance brigades affiliated with the Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement Hamas, the Islamic Jihad Movement, and the Palestinian Fatah Movement, and in terms of the decisive support of the Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip, the occupied West Bank, the city of Al-Quds, the occupied 1948 territories and those residing in various refugee camps. The Israeli side was completely divided, with anti-Netanyahu demonstrations and clashes between Muslims and Jews in the 1948 territories ranging on during the war. Point number five. An important point is that the Zionist regime is waiting for the next war from today onwards. It has accepted the fact that the Palestinians can also manage a war and bring it to a conclusion. This issue deprives the Israeli army of security. Earlier, the leaders of the Zionist army introduced Iran and Hezbollah as their first and second threats, something which is true, but this war showed that the main threat is much closer at home than they realized. This threat lies within the Palestinian borders from its owners. Of course, this does not mean to write off the regime's concerns about Iran and Hezbollah. It means that Palestine itself has become the first threat to the Israeli regime, and this is a new phenomena. Now, the Palestinian side has hundreds of reasons to resist against Israeli attacks, so the war could happen at any moment, something which strongly renders the regime's policy-making shaky. An Israeli regime that is waiting for the response and defense of resistance forces at any moment and rocket fire on its cities from north and south, how can it plan for its future and hope for its implementation? So to sum up, we can say that the Zionist regime no longer has stability, has no future, and collapse is the most common word in its lexicon from now on.
The recent Israeli aggression against the besieged Gaza Strip began on May 10th, after the Israeli regime attacked worshippers in Al-Aqsa Mosque and started eviction plans of the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in the occupied East Jerusalem Al-Quds. This wasn't the first time the besieged territory came under Israeli fire. However, this time Palestinians turned the tables against the regime and launched unprecedented rocket and drone attacks on Israeli cities, inflicting damage and casualties on the enemy. Finally, after 11 days of brutal Israeli attacks that killed at least 279 Palestinians, including 69 children, the occupying regime announced a unilateral ceasefire on Friday, which was accepted by Palestinian resistance groups with Egyptian mediation. People in the besieged Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank hailed the truce as a victory for Palestinian resistance groups in the face of Israel's attacks. The 11-day-long Israeli aggression resulted in the displacement of over 90,000 Gazans and the destruction of Gaza's critical infrastructure and many civilian buildings. International NGOs and Gaza officials say several hospitals and schools, as well as power and sewage plants, have been severely damaged. The Red Cross says that Gaza could take years to rebuild. Moreover, Palestinian lawyers say the Israeli army's use of live fire and rubber-coated bullets from short range against Palestinian demonstrators is a war crime. Meanwhile, Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad al-Maliki has sent a letter to the International Criminal Court's prosecutor's office, including documents on new and ongoing crimes, calling for an investigation into Israel's war crimes in Gaza, West Bank, and Jerusalem al-Quds.
I think that now, following the horrific damage that Israel did, wherein it targeted homes medical centers, press buildings. These are all in blatant violation of international law. And much as Israel liked to say that Hamas had some presence there, there is no evidence to support that. So I think this time, with an investigation about to begin regarding possible war crimes that Israel committed in 2014, I do believe that these will be added to it.
Following a ceasefire between Tel Aviv and Palestinian resistance groups, after 11 days of Israel's deadly war on the Gaza Strip, Hamas and the military wing of the Islamic Jihad movement, Al-Quds Brigades, thanked Iran for its unwavering support for the Palestinian resistance, saying Iran is a partner in the victory against Israel. Iran's leader, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, congratulated Palestinians for their victory against Israel. Ayatollah Khamenei noted that Palestinians' resistance left the Zionist regime with no choice but to request a ceasefire.
The regime's defeat was manifested both in its continued crimes and its request for a ceasefire. The Israeli regime was forced to concede defeat.
The Iranian leader noted that the Israeli regime will get weaker than what it is today, while the preparedness of resistance forces will make Palestine stronger day by day. He also called on the entire Muslim nations to feel responsible for the Palestinian cause.
Muslim governments should enter the scene with sincerity to support the Palestinian nation, whether by boosting their military might or lending financial support. This is required more than ever before for the reconstruction of the infrastructure and repairing the damage done to Gaza.
Ayatollah Khamenei emphasized that the crimes Israel committed during its latest onslaught should not be left unpunished. He said Israeli authorities, particularly Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, must be brought to justice in independent international tribunals.
The defeat will indirectly do that, because Israel has seen, the Israeli government has seen, that it no longer has the level of support around the world that it once believed it had. People spoke up in the streets. There were mass demonstrations in support of Palestine around the world. Many governments, although they were critical of Hamas, unjustly critical, they were also critical of Israel. This is new. Israel no longer can do whatever it wants with complete impunity.
Israel launched an offensive on the Gaza Strip and approved a ceasefire without any preconditions or strategic breakthrough. This means the Palestinian resistance has taught Israelis an important lesson, and that is the Israeli enemy is incapable of facing Palestine's united uprising.
Palestinians have poured to the streets to celebrate their victory over Israel in the 11-day fighting between the two sides. Rallies were held across the besieged Gaza Strip in condemnation of the Israeli regime and celebration of its defeat. Gatherings were also held in the occupied West Bank, where joyful participants cheered for the victory for the resistance. The celebrations came after an Egypt-brokered ceasefire went into effect on Friday morning, ending the fiercest battle there in years. This wasn't the first time the besieged territory came under Israeli fire, but this time, Palestinians turned the tables against the regime and launched unprecedented rocket and drone attacks on Israeli cities, inflicting damage and casualties on the enemy. Experts believe that Israel has succumbed to the unprecedented response by the Palestinian resistance and agreed to the ceasefire without any preconditions.
I think it's a huge win. The fact is that never before have we seen Israel penetrated militarily, psychologically, and morally in this way before. The sheer numbers of Palestinian resistance missiles that actually penetrated the Iron Dome is absolutely incredible. This much-vaunted dome, which was meant to protect the Israeli civilians, essentially collapsed, because my estimation is around 30% of the missiles got through. And what were these missiles? Essentially, they were just homemade rockets. Not only that, what we've seen is that This, for the first time, turned into an insurrection within occupied Palestinian territory. Within the colony itself, they call Israel, you saw huge numbers of Palestinians demonstrating and rising up, and actually huge clashes took place. A lot of that would have been suppressed.
People across the world have shown their solidarity with Palestinians in the past few days. In the United States, protesters called for the cessation of all funding to Israel. As the Israeli regime was targeting the people of Palestine, the U.S. administration approved the sale of $735 million in precision-guided weapons to the Israeli regime. The arms deal is now pending the approval of Congress. Several American congresspeople, including Senator Bernie Sanders and House Representatives Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Mark Pocan, and Rashida Tlaib, objected to the plan and introduced motions to block the sales. But given the traditionally strong support for Israel in the Congress, the motions will almost certainly fail.
The U.S. is totally $3.5 billion per annum is donated by Israel to by America to Israel in order to sustain its arms industry. As the bombs were falling Palestinian children, you found that Joe Biden cleared $750 million of aid for arms and missiles to Israel. So that was the initial response of America.
In the meantime, U.S. President Joe Biden has welcomed the ceasefire, expressing hope that it would hold. He, however, reaffirmed the U.S. support for the Israeli regime. Several Israeli political and military figures have questioned Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's motives for launching the offensive on the Gaza Strip and approving a ceasefire without any strategic breakthrough for the regime. Netanyahu's political opponents speculate that the premier ordered the strikes after he failed to establish a coalition cabinet to put an end to Israel's political stalemate. But the developments over the past 2 weeks have shown that the next time the regime ventures an offensive against Gaza, it could face consequences more serious than a political vacuum in Tel Aviv.
The United States and its arch-rival China may have toned down their rhetoric against each other compared to the chaotic era of former U.S. President Donald Trump. But tensions between the two superpowers are simmering as they remain deeply engaged in an intense global rivalry. There are many flashpoints in their testy relationship, one being the resource-rich South China Sea. Chinese and American military vessels have had numerous encounters there. This week, China said an American warship illegally entered its territorial waters in the sea, but was expelled by Chinese ships and planes. Beijing was quick to slam the U.S. action, branding it as a violation of China's sovereignty. Beijing warned that such moves undermine regional peace and stability. However, the U.S. Navy said its vessel asserted navigational rights and freedoms near a number of islands claimed by China, Taiwan, and Vietnam. China believes that America has fully abandoned its supposed neutrality in the region and is clearly siding with nations which have rival territorial claims in the South China Sea.
The United States is trying to transform these maritime disputes in the South China Sea. These are typical maritime disputes that you'll find all over the world, including in places like Europe, between European nations. The U.S. is trying to transform this from mere disputes into a regional, even global conflict, because they need to have a pretext to justify their military remaining in the region.
Naval tensions between the U.S. and China are not limited to the South China Sea. Earlier this week, an American destroyer sailed through the Taiwan Strait, angering Beijing, which considers self-ruled Taiwan a breakaway region that must one day be reunited with the mainland. China wants the U.S. to respect its territorial integrity and has repeatedly warned that this red line must never be crossed. Technological rivalry between the United States and China is expanding fast, especially in highly advanced sectors like 5G, artificial intelligence, and the semiconductor industry. The U.S. Senate voted this week to advance a bill authorizing well over $100 billion for technology research in the face of Chinese rivalry. The Endless Frontier Act is a huge investment in emerging sciences and manufacturing on a scale not seen in decades. The legislation has bipartisan support. Politicians from both major camps in the United States have a rising sense of urgency to bolster America's ability to compete with China. The urgency was also highlighted in U.S. President Joe Biden's first speech to Congress last month. During his address, the U.S. president left no doubt that America will do its utmost to outpace the Asian superpower in terms of trade and technology. Biden identifies China as the toughest foreign policy challenge. His administration is trying hard to reduce American reliance on Chinese technology in areas that Washington believes raise national security risks and protect critical technologies from being transferred to China. The U.S. president has also said the American military will maintain a strong presence in the Indo-Pacific, where the U.S. has been trying to contain the growing influence of its arch rival. The Biden administration has toned down anti-Beijing rhetoric, but what's certain is that America is determined to follow policies aimed at containing the Chinese influence worldwide.
The United States has been the sole superpower for decades, and then with the resurgence of Russia and now China's rise, they're watching their global primacy slip away. So even though there's many excuses for why they have this conflict with China, the main reason is they cannot accept that China, even though it has a larger population and plenty of resources, they cannot accept the fact that China is going to surpass them.
As the U.S. intensifies efforts against its main global rival, China is expected to pursue its own ways to catch up with and even overtake America in different fields.
The boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement has urged people around the world to boycott Israeli and multinational firms complicit in Tel Aviv's regime's abuse of Palestinian human rights. A fresh call comes amid Israel's relentless bombardment of the Gaza Strip. There's a growing consensus that Israel now, like South Africa in the past, is an apartheid state that must be met with targeted sanctions, boycotts, and divestments.
Well, I would not say that the governments of any countries have the will to try and boycott Israel or take any really clear measures against Israel. But I would say that among students and among, for example, the Arab American movement in the U.S., I think there is more of a will to say, no, we have to cut off the arms to Israel. We have to cut off the aid and the trade to Israel, exactly as we did with apartheid South Africa. There's more of a will to say that.
The movement says the measures can help challenge the complicity of international firms in Israeli crimes against Palestinians and help the struggle of Palestinians for freedom, justice, and equality. BDS activists are now trying to translate the activism that has been generated among celebrities and cultural icons into meaningful change. Football figures in the UK and the Arab world, Black Lives Matter activists in the UK, as well as several progressive U.S. lawmakers, have voiced their opposition to Israeli crimes against Palestinians in the occupied territories. The movement says there is growing consensus that, like South Africa in the past, Israel is an apartheid regime that must be met with action.
These students have built up a level of confidence now that makes them react more loudly when Israel starts mass bombardments of the Palestinian people. So you have more confident crowds of protesters, and that is driving these few liberal politicians to push President Biden in the direction of cutting off the military aid to Israel. And Biden is an old Zionist who doesn't want to do that ever, but they are pushing him more in that direction.
A fresh round of violence started after Israeli troops and settlers announced plans to expel dozens of Palestinians from the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in occupied East Jerusalem Al-Quds. Illegal Israeli settlers are looking to take over the properties of Palestinian families. This is not an isolated incident. Since its creation in 1948, Israel has used discriminatory and racist policies against Palestinians in various forms. There is now a general consensus that the racist policies of the Israeli regime are similar to the ones implemented by the apartheid regime in South Africa.
Black Lives Matter is more loud and clear and confident about opposing Israel because Israel so much resembles apartheid South Africa. And the willingness of some politicians, as you mentioned, AOC, Rashida Tlaib, and Ilhan Omar, the willingness of some politicians to oppose Israel, to oppose aid to Israel, is something new. They are gradually inching their way towards saying cut off the military aid to Israel. They're not there.
The BDS movement seeks to raise global awareness about these policies and discourage companies from doing business with the occupiers of Palestinian lands. The BDS movement, which is modeled after the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa, was initiated in 2005 by over 170 Palestinian organizations that were pushing for various forms of boycott against Israel until it met its obligations under international law. Thousands of volunteers worldwide have since then joined the BDS movement. Israel has spared no effort to undermine the movement. Back in 2011, the Knesset passed a measure to curb its activities.
I cannot think of anything more foolish than to say that you want to have any kind of divestment or sanctions or whatever, or boycott against a country that, when all is said and done, is the only democracy in the region.
We must continue to stand firm against the profoundly biased campaign to delegitimize the state of Israel through boycotts, divestment, and sanctions.
The BDS movement is often linked to those kinds of frames. So I will continue to condemn the BDS movement.
The Tel Aviv regime has started a huge lobby campaign with pro-Israeli groups around the world to undermine the BDS. Back in 2019, U.S. House lawmakers passed a bipartisan resolution condemning the movement.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. A theory as to why children generally appear less susceptible to the coronavirus than adults is that they have less of a type of receptor known as ACE2 in their respiratory tract. These receptors are a key pathway for the entry of the virus that causes COVID-19 to enter the cells. It is theorized fewer ACE2 receptors means fewer opportunities for the virus to take hold. We have prepared for you an article written by Melissa Davey. The piece is titled Children with COVID, Why Are Some Countries Seeing More Cases and Deaths? The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Emergency physicians and leading epidemiologist in Brazil, Dr. Fatima Marinho, is seeing symptoms of COVID-19 in children that starkly contrast with the message that has been relayed globally throughout the pandemic, that children do not appear to suffer severely from the coronavirus. Dr. Fatima Marinho says severe muscle aches, diarrhea, coughing, abdominal pain and hospitalization, all of these are happening to children with COVID-19 in Brazil. The latest available data extracted by Marinho on 15th of April showed 2,216 children aged between 0 and 9 had died from COVID-19. This includes 1,397 babies under the age of 1. Meanwhile, more than 67,000 children in the 0 to 9 years old age group have been hospitalized in Brazil. Dr. Fatima Marinho, a senior advisor to the global public health organization Vital Strategies, tells The Guardian newspaper, the epidemic in Brazil is changing the profile of severe cases. She says, we see more young people hospitalized and dying by COVID compared to 2020. She added, soon Brazil must start to vaccinate young people because of the risk due to the new variants of the virus, but there isn't enough vaccine. On Saturday, 22nd of May, the World Health Organization, WHO, urged wealthier countries who had completed vaccinating their most vulnerable to delay vaccinating children and instead donate those vaccine doses to its COVAX facility so they can be distributed to countries most in need. Vaccinations of children has already begun in some countries, with Canada and the United States among those vaccinating 12 to 15-year-olds. World Health Organization's Director General, Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, said, in low and lower middle-income countries, COVID-19 vaccine supply has not been enough to even immunize healthcare workers, and hospitals are being inundated with people that need life-saving care urgently. He added, I understand why some countries want to vaccinate their children and adolescents, but right now I urge them to reconsider and to instead donate those vaccines to the COVAX program. But among those requiring life-saving care in countries still being ravaged by the virus, including India, Brazil, and Indonesia, are children. So why is COVID-19 infecting and affecting children so severely in some countries, but not in others, to the point where some countries may forego vaccinating children for the time being? While more research is needed, Dr. Fatima Marinho says there are several factors playing a role. One is that diagnosis of COVID-19 in children is coming too late, when children are already severely unwell and treatment is more difficult. She says there is a culture of there is no risk for children, so physicians don't think in terms of COVID-19, adding, as well as low access to timely healthcare, there is also poverty and inequalities involved, and people living in areas and houses with difficulty in social distancing. In poor houses, there are more than 4 people per room. Marinho says social distancing outside the home is also difficult. She says members of the family must go out every day for work or searching for a job. She added, new SARS-CoV-2 variants also have a higher viral load compared to other variants. This means people are also more infectious. She noted that Brazil needs more tests for COVID-19. Without testing and tracking cases and controls, the virus cannot be controlled and will continue spreading around the country. The risk is new mutations of the virus. In Indonesia, the Indonesian Pediatrician Association said official figures that suggest 20